welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And don't forget, your campaign begins today. If you're planning on running, if you're planning on taking back the government by demanding full compliance and that you will be compliant to the Constitution, then it's got to begin today. Because you have 2 years if it's a two-year race, 4 years if it's a four-year race, and start working your PR campaign against those scoundrels who are in office and so forth. And so please also consider, you know, using your spiritual tool chest, joining with, excuse me, Loudoun Liberty, or create your own prayer circle, but they have a daily prayer circle. I just want to remind you, on the Red State Talk Radio podcast page, that's where you can find the info to connecting to the Zoom channel that happens, I think, the time is there. I want to say it's 11 o'clock PST. Pacific Standard Time, because we're in Standard Time now, and so we just got out of Daylight Time, and we'll get back to Daylight Time in March, and I hate Daylight Time. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, but I don't like it.
Because the springing forward and the falling back, we just need to stop it, because we now live in a time where, you know, we actually live in a 24-hour world today. Back in the time when they created daylight savings time, that was a daylight time. In other words, when the sun went down, everything ended until the next morning. So anyway, well, so we're in the process of reading Madison's notes on nullification. We're in the process of reading paragraph 14. Now, I jumped in and read the therefore cannot be, there cannot be, I should say, the different laws. So why don't we pick it up from there? Because this is important, because as things move forward, he kind of starts pointing out that all of these things are interconnected. The taxation is a part of this. So let's go ahead. And this is why it's so important to force constitutional compliance upon the federal government. Interposition doesn't just end with getting them out. Ending these unconstitutional powers, ending these unconstitutional laws that they've created, all of this stuff has to be undone. Go ahead.
Where are we starting?
So there cannot be the red text in 14.
Okay. There cannot be different laws in different states on subjects within the compact without subverting its fundamental principles and rendering it as abortive in practice as it would be incongruous in theory.
Okay, and keep going.
A concurrence and cooperation of the states in favor of each would have the effect of preserving the necessary uniformity in all which the Constitution so carefully and specifically provided for in cases where the rule might be in most danger of being violated.
Okay, so basically what he's saying is he was anticipating a unanimous assertion. He couldn't fathom that it would only need to be a majority. He couldn't fathom a government that had abandoned the Constitution to the degree that we see today, where it's actually waging war upon the Union. I mean, he spoke, and we've read, where these dangerous assertions, these palpable violations, are so dangerous to the Union that we're literally at that point. I mean, that's why when I look at what they were doing, some people would view it as hyperbole. But they realized that once there was a breach, the erosion would take effect. And look at how far we've eroded. So keep going.
Thus, the citizens of every state are to enjoy reciprocally the privileges of the citizens in every other state.
There you go. So we need to bring back the uniformity in compliance. It can't just be a few states. That's one of the reasons why we needed the 14th Amendment. We needed Section 3 to force every public servant, barring the president and the vice president, everyone else had to be fully compliant or they had to be removed. Now read this part.
Direct taxes are to be apportioned on all according to a fixed rule. Indirect taxes are to be the same in all states. The duties on imports are to be uniform. No preference is to be given to the ports of one state over those of another.
Okay, so I'm going to take an aside on this because this is why this is really highlighted with the, what is that, pink or fuchsia, whatever, with the yellow font. Think about the 16th Amendment. Okay? Think about the 16th Amendment. Now reread this. Go ahead, reread this, thinking about the 16th Amendment.
Okay. Direct taxes are to be apportioned on all according to a fixed rule. Indirect taxes are to be the same in all the states. The duties on imports are to be uniform. No preference is to be given to the ports of one state over those of another.
Everything must be uniform. How is it that we have an income tax where I pay a different rate than somebody else, where some states actually pay at higher rates than other states? And how is that? Because other states like California would provide tax credits so that they didn't have to pay their own state taxes. So we have, I'll just say, America gone wild on taxes because it is not uniform as far as the federal taxes and the way the shenanigans are. Because bottom line, if you can write off your taxes, what you pay in federal taxes against your state taxes, then you actually are, the state is just taking that one step further and pitting, you know, many against others. Many being those on the entitlement against those who are really making money that aren't having the protections. Those that don't have the special laws created, like the billionaires, so that they don't even pay taxes. Okay, keep going.
Can it be believed that with these provisions of the Constitution illustrating its vital principles fully in view of the legislature of Virginia, that its members could, in the resolution quoted, intend to countenance a right in a single state to distinguish itself from its co-states by avoiding the burdens or restrictions borne by them or indirectly giving the law to them?
So now let's jump down, because what we're going to do is jump down to 20. Let me think, that's where we want to start. Okay. Now, he's going to take a different approach, and then we're going to jump down, I think, into the 40s. But he's going to try to say the same things in a different way. He goes around the mulberry bush several times. He gets to a point, I think, in the 50s or the 60s, where he actually sounds like he's defending nullification. Don't be misled. He's only taking what they would say, you know, he's basically putting himself into their shoes and creating a, you know, how they look positively upon that. And then he basically, you know, identifies the shortcomings in their vision. It's really hard to follow when you start hitting that. And if you stop right there, and this is how I find that there are people out there that take parts of this, and we're going to actually get into part of this, where the John Birch Society and the 10th Amendment Center actually have completely misinterpreted this document. And they come right out and they basically cite, you know, Madison's Notes on Nullification and this quotation down in the 40s where Jefferson himself said that every state could nullify. And
And they just run with that. Oh, yeah, Jefferson himself said every state could nullify whatever law they wanted. Okay, so go ahead and start with 20.
Okay, hold on. I got to go back. Okay. Here it distinctly appears, as in the third resolution, that the course contemplated by the legislature for maintaining the authorities, rights, and liberties reserved to the states respectively was not a solitary or separate interposition, but a cooperation in the means necessary and proper for the purpose.
Okay. So now he provides the elucidation or the insights. Go ahead.
If a further elucidation of the view of the legislature could be needed, it happens to be found in its recorded proceedings. In the seventh resolution, as originally proposed, the term unconstitutional was followed by null and void.
Uh-huh, keep going.
And these added words being considered by some as giving pretext for some disorganizing misconstruction were unanimously stricken out, or rather withdrawn by the mover of the resolutions.
Okay. Keep going.
And an attempt has been made by ascribing to the word stricken out a nullifying signification to fix on the reputed draftsman of the resolution the character of a nullifier.
Yeah, that term right there, that's a derogatory term towards these people who have taken on life to this single state nullification principle. That's who a nullifier is, the character of a nullifier. Keep going.
Could this have been effected? It would have vindicated the legislature the more effectually from the imputation of favoring the doctrine of South Carolina. The unanimous erasure of nullifying expressions was a protest by the House of Delegates in the most emphatic form against it.
Right. Now it says delates, but actually it's delegates, hyphenated. And so what he's really laying out here is that, you know, and this is where I wanted to show that Madison is actually speaking so candidly. Every time you read him, he's always saying in the good gentleman and the fair man or what have you. Now he actually has a little pet name, a derogatory pet name called the nullifiers.
But kind of like the liberals.
Right. Okay. And that's what we do. But back in those days, they maintained a civil tongue. As he talks about, you know, this unanimously stricken out is something that requires force, political force. Madison perceived that the men of integrity and honor back in 1798, that they felt that all of the states would have got on board. They were flabbergasted by the fact that they didn't. What was their option because they didn't? I wish Madison would have spoke to this. I wish Madison would have actually gone out of his way to say, look, you know, we got away with a coup. We didn't have to revolt. We didn't have to, you know, use Section 3 or anything like that. They actually had, I just want to say, the direct hand of the divine hand of Providence assisting them in doing what was necessary in putting this nation back on its course. We don't have Madison and Jefferson today. Now, down in paragraph 25, there's a part here that's highlighted in blue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so let's read paragraph 25, because this happens to be an outlier paragraph that's not necessarily talking, or at least the point I'm driving on this isn't about nullification and interposition. Go ahead and read this one.
Okay. It must be recollected that this document proceeded from the representatives chosen by the people some months after the resolutions had been before them, with a longer period for manifesting their sentiments, before the report was adopted and without any evidence of disapprobation in the constituent body. On the contrary, it is known to have been recorded by the Republican Party a decided majority of the people with the most entire approbation.
Okay, so he actually reports that there was a Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't call them the Democratic Republicans.
Yeah, true.
Okay. Now, actually, if I take the word Republican, because we're going to jump now, and because I know it's in here again, and if we go to the next case, actually, I'm going to take party. Single state party. That's not what I want to do. Because he talks about creating the Republican Party. And I don't know. I think we just hit it here. But I believe somewhere down the line, he talks about why they created the party. And it'll be in blue. And as a matter of fact, I think it's down in 61 where he brings up the Republican Party again. And then...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is 61.
Okay. Anyway, I believe somewhere in here he talks about the necessity of creating this party. And so, bottom line, when he's referring to the Republican Party here, the... RPU. The point that I'm trying to bring up is that he's actually referring to the fact that the state of Virginia, right? Does he not kind of infer that the state of Virginia actually seemed to be a part of that Republican Party?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So, because he says, he follows it with, a decided majority of the people with the most entire approbation. Okay, so in other words, there were a lot of people that were really going, oh. Anyway, the highlighted part in green is he basically, this consideration makes it more extraordinary, and let it be added, the more inexcusable in those who, in the zeal to extract a particular meaning from a particular resolution, not only shut their eyes to another resolution, but to an authentic exposition of both. And so, he's really going through and out of his way, like I said, in scolding these people. He's really calling them out directly. And so let's go ahead and read 26 and 27.
Okay, and what is the comment of the report on that particular resolution, namely the third? In the first place, it conforms to the resolution in using the term which expresses the interposing authority of the states in the plural number states, not in the singular number state. It is indeed impossible not to perceive that the entire current and complexion of the observations explaining and vindicating the resolutions, that's a period, right?
Right, no. Resolutions. That's an abbreviation.
Imply necessarily that by the interposition of the states for arresting the evil of usurpation was meant a concurring authority, not that a single state, whilst the collective meaning of the term gives consistency and effect to the reasoning and the object.
Okay, so he's basically repeating himself, and he's just going through the importance of the plural of states. We can't just do this alone, or you have to secede. I am convinced that when one state gets on board and starts pushing, Wyoming can lead the charge. And then next thing you know, Idaho, Montana, another state will actually wake up and say, we can do this too, and we will do this. And again, like I said, it'll start going to where that state will completely flip. What do I mean by completely flip? It will change its paradigm from party, compromise and party control over government to government or public servants have this party control or this public servants, the Democrats and Republicans, can compromise and do whatever they choose. They have unlimited powers. The flip will be that the parties have no play in anything other than those things delegated. In other words, if there's going to be compromise, it is only compromising the things delegated. I use this example of war, that the parties can decide, they'll compromise whether we go to war or not. That's the only thing that the party has the privilege of compromising. They cannot compromise over something not delegated. Yeah, we're going to do this energy thing. We're going to put up, you know, solar panels and wind, you know, windmills. The fact that your state legislature and all these state legislatures are bringing these things in, they're getting paid to do so. And in so doing, they're getting other money that's coming into their campaigns. In other words, this is all unconstitutional. And the point is that they will, we get these points to the state where we actually flip. People will now understand that compromise is not obtainable on things not delegated.
Right.
You can't even talk about it. We will get to a point where they will be, they won't even have to have laws. They will have an enforcer in the state legislature that any person that brings forth a bill that would inject something that would be a compromise of something not delegated. In other words, hey, we all want to talk and kind of come to a point where we agree that we need to provide health care. Even though it's not delegated, we're going to do this. The person that brings that bill in will be removed.
Yeah.
Because they have directly violated their oath by actually injecting something that would be violating the Constitution. Now, when I say the Constitution, the state Constitution, because in that particular case, in a state scenario, if it's not delegated, they can't do it. Those people who injected the Affordable Care Act in, 2009, those few folks that injected that, they need to be removed. Those people who voted for it, they also must be removed. We have so many people at the federal level that for so many reasons, they need to be removed, that one has to scratch one's head and say, we have to draw a line here. And I think that at this point, moving forward, and I think this is where the people, when we flip, when it happens and we get states to start flipping, they will come to the conclusion that those who, you know, had the compulsion, you know, I'll just say they had the conscience of questioning, is this really moral? Can we really do this? And people say, yes, we can. This is how we do things. At least they hesitated. At least they didn't dive in willingly. Now, if they actually change over time to become one of the, yeah, this is how we do it, we're going to just ram all of this stuff down their throat. When they get into that camp, they're gone. Those people don't get a first and final. Those people that actually have reservations say, I don't think we should be doing this. Well, that's what we have to do. And, okay, I'm a good Democrat, I'll vote for that, because I'm just thinking that there might be such a thing as a good Democrat. We know that there's very few good Republicans. There might be a good Democrat. Chances are not likely. So the fact is that when we flip, I believe that the spirit will get to a point, and we're going to go into a break. We're going to be going into the promo in just a sec. But I think that when we get to that point, that at the state level, the state will actually demand so harshly full compliance that they will start purging themselves. It's like when you hit that button on an oven for self-cleaning, all of a sudden the heat really gets intense. We'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and read through 28, 29, 30. What I want to do is I just really want to point out how Madison is laboring over the emphasis of the parties. It just can't be done by a single state. We can't save the Constitution by a single state. We cannot save our liberties. We are eternally entwined as states to each other in this union. As I say, when one state joins the union, they basically create a compact, an agreement with all states that are in the union, that it will work with each of them to make sure that we cooperate. In other words, the spirit of the, you know, the sibling family, or this, you know, law of marriage of states, the marriage of these states coming together, there is this, you know, shared agreement, because Madison didn't even talk that while the states are in the union, they have the privilege of enjoying the benefits and the blessings that come from being in the union. Well, in it, you know, on the flip side of that, when they don't hold the federal government accountable and let them do what they're doing to us, then we also equally have to suffer together. They're killing us. And so the only way we can actually get that federal government, it's not about just making an appeal and operating outside of that. When we actually look at the Constitution compliance, before we actually start really acting, we actually go through a full audit first. And that's when we actually start communicating out to the states. Before we, you got to remember that we don't have to immediately secede, because as far as I'm concerned, you have a natural right to defend yourself. If we're at that point where the state of Wyoming actually basically conveys to the states all along the way their findings, and when they provide their final findings, all of these things of the federal government, all of these laws that were created by the court, all of these executive orders that have been created by the presidency or the executive, all of these usurped powers, assumed roles, responsibilities, powers, properties, and so forth, all of these things are unconstitutional. In other words, they're creating the table of tyranny, because this table is comprehensive. It is only when they finalize that table where Wyoming begins to act, and they've basically finally said, okay, here you go. Let us know what you think. Now, it shouldn't take too long, but Wyoming at that point can actually start sending the message. We're moving forward, and we're getting the federal government out of our knickers. We're taking back full control. Now, if other states start getting on board, then at that point, you know, you want to let the momentum move itself before anybody secedes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You don't secede until you can't create critical mass. Right. And then we actually have to allow these states to secede. And when that happens, we got to make sure that there's this hesitation and not a rush to secede. We have to hasten interposition Madison even talks about the dangers of hastening, but folks, you know, there's even a greater danger in ignoring, the tyranny that has been inflicted upon us. You know, it's pathetic that people are scratching their heads today going, and I see this. I see all of these entertainers out there. Who was it? Somebody was just sending me something. I don't know, Dan Bongino or Rogan or, you know, whoever these people are talking about, oh, well, we got to, you know, get rid of some of these powers. No, no, no. We have to audit the Constitution, identify everything that does not belong, and it's all got to go. It's all got to go. You want those things? You need to put it, because what has to happen is all of these things get identified that they've got to go. And before anything actually starts happening, we have to wait for that critical mass so that then it is actualized in the House, in Congress and the Senate, both the House and the Senate of Congress, where Congress now, those states, okay, so I'm going to go back to that state map, right? And I'm going to basically give you that these states, Wyoming, South Dakota, West Virginia, North Dakota, Idaho, Arkansas, Utah, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, South Carolina, Florida, Indiana, Louisiana, Ohio, Missouri, Kansas, Montana, Wisconsin, Mississippi, Iowa, Alaska, North Carolina, Texas, Georgia. And I think at that point, We should have enough states in the union. We still have more red states to go. Arizona may be the next one. But at this point, with these 26 states, why 26? Well, what does it take to have a majority control in the state? When your state is flipped, in other words, if you're not going to support the Constitution, you're removed. In other words, there's this flip that it becomes scorched earth. In other words, there's zero tolerance for a public servant in that state or representing that state at the federal level, that you will be removed. So that means that if you, by the time we get to this point, any person that is a Democrat will be a constitutional Democrat. They're a Democrat in name only because they're constitutional first. And they will support anything and everything that is required. If they don't, they will be removed. Does that make sense? Am I belaboring this too much? Because by the time these states flip, you got these 26 states, they should already have full compliance out of Congress, where when they finally send these 26 states, send the directive to their folks and demand that the legislature, all they need to do is have enough of these people sponsor and push the state, or not the state, the Speaker of the House into, you know, letting them vote on this so that they can actually initiate these directives that will actually basically decommission and dismantle the Department of Education. Decommission and dismantle the Health and Human Services Department, the Department of Housing, the Department of Labor, all of these things, along with the laws, that they're going to have all of these different directives that will say, this is to be, and when it comes to a power, like a department, it needs to be done, you know, comprehensively. In other words, every part of that department needs to be either gotten rid of, or if there's anything that is perceived that would be still within the Constitution. Now, could there be something within the department that might be still within the Constitution? The Department of Transportation would be a good example. The Coast Guard is something that is still in the Constitution. What would happen is the Coast Guard would need to be moved from the Department of Transportation into the Department of Defense. And then the rest of it would be disbanded and decommissioned. Or maybe there's something else. But this is why we go through it and we have to cross our T's and dot our I's. Yeah, this is work. But as we have this 26-state majority at this point, where these 26 states have flipped, they've taken back their states, and now they're forcing the federal government into full compliance. They know they can't just ignore it. They have to continue the interposition to finalize the alignment of the federal government to the framework of the Constitution once again. In other words, getting the genie back in the bottle. That makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, good. So where did we leave off here out of the 28 through? Go ahead.
Hold on.
If you need to, let's just start again with 28.
Okay. That's where we're at, actually.
Okay.
We're on 28. But besides this general evidence that the report and the invariable use of the plural term states withheld from a single state, the right expressed in the resolution, a still more precise and decisive inference to the same effect is afforded by several passages in the document.
Okay, keep going. Because I've already kind of covered, this is just a re-expression of stuff, but yeah, let's go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thus the report observes, the states then being the parties to the Constitutional Compact, and in their highest sovereign capacity, it follows of necessity that there can be no tribunal above their authority to decide in the last resort whether the compact made by them be violated, and consequently that as the parties to it, they must themselves decide in the last resort such questions as may be of sufficient magnitude to require their interposition.
Okay, so that right there is a citation out of Madison's report, not the resolutions. Okay, so this final 30 here.
Okay. Now, apart from the palpable insufficiency of an interposition by a single state to effect the declared object of the interposition, namely to maintain authorities and rights which must be the same in all the states, it is not true that there would be no tribunal above the authority of a state as a single party, the aggregate right. authority of the parties being a tribunal above it to decide in the last resort.
Right. And so when you actually get a majority of the states, excuse me, when you have a majority of the states standing firm and saying this is how it has to be, then those other states, regardless of their population, and a good case in point is California may actually have a population that could be possibly greater than the majority of the 26 states, or a good percentage of it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so regardless of the population, each state is a party, a single party. And ergo, it requires a plurality, a majority of states, even though some of the states may feel like they have a superior representation or a superior position. They don't. They're all equal. And ergo, what he's basically laying out is that the majority becomes the tribunal. Because as California comes in and says, we're not allowing this. And if they try to demand that they have 50 votes over the 20-some-odd, then the 20-some-odd would say, you only get one vote. That's not how it plays here. That's not how it played in the beginning. And you can't change the rules because you don't like what we're doing. Now, let me address this because this is where Keith Broders has kind of brought this up. And he says that, well, if California sees what's happening, then they may want to secede from the union. Well, we're not going to address that immediately in this point of the recovery or the reclaiming of the republic. But once we're done, and once we've got the government in a line, any state that has decided to secede because they want to rebel against the union, or I should say the leadership of that state thinks that they want to rebel against the union, then the leadership of that state will be actually seized and removed. Because a state has a right to secede when it is dealing with unconstitutional tyranny. But when they're facing constitutionality and compliance, you don't have a right to secede out of the Union. You only have a right to break the compact when it is being violated. That's the whole point. When the contract, or the, I should say, the Constitution has a breach to it, that breach of a part is basically tantamount to a breach of the whole. Now, Madison in his report basically says that it must be both willful and meaningful, like meaningful and willful. In other words, it has to be significant in nature and both willful. And in other words, they're deliberately doing this. Now, is it willful? I think I mentioned this before. The fact that they're spraying us, is that willful, or is that just something that is just accidentally happening?
It's definitely willful.
That's right. Okay, so we have both willful and meaningful. In other words, these things are very significant. They're trying to kill us. Now, there's a lot of stuff that I would tell you to read on and read on and read on. And so he talks, and this is right here is where he's really diving into the report. And in 33, this is what Madison says. Here is direct proof that the authority, what he provided above, that is the direct proof that the authority of the Supreme Court of the United States was understood by the legislature of Virginia to have been blank to an interposition. In other words, they're not the arbitrary authorities. So that blank, I wish I knew what that was, but that was something that just did not transpose in the document. Now, we actually, when you look at these things in the footers, we have links to the source document. So you can go look at these abbreviations and what he says. Anyway, as we kind of move along, I want to go down to where we see Thomas Jefferson. And this is right here in 44. So what I'd like to do is basically jump down to 41, because this is where he kind of builds upon the nullification again. So he's going to reassert these things, and he's going to keep, you know, ticking, ticking, ticking. But he's going to bring up this concept, how the nullifiers of their time were taking liberties with using and citing Jefferson for supporting nullification. Okay? So go ahead and let's start with 41.
Okay. Thus, during the temporary nullification of the law, the results... what's that stand for? Would. That's what it is. The results would be the same with those proceedings for an unqualified nullification. And the results of a convention might be that 7 out of the 24 states might make the temporary results permanent. It follows that any state which could obtain the concurrence of 6 others might abrogate any law of the U.S., whatever constructively, and give to the Constitution any shape they please, in opposition to the construction and will of the other 17, each of the 17 having an equal right and authority with each of the 7.
Okay, so what he's kind of pointing out here is a minority can't control the majority. So he doesn't come out and say, and I think, again, the paradigm when they were writing these resolutions was that they were going to get all the states. Now, they had this coup. They took over. And now that the South, in the 1830s, late 1820s, the South was receiving these harassments, or I should say, the Union was passing, or the federal government was passing laws that was actually causing harm. And they didn't like it. And the South basically said, we can take a minority and control the majority. And that flies in the face of reason. That's why he's basically saying, this can't work that way. And instead of saying it requires a majority, he keeps on just saying it requires a plurality. But he doesn't make it clear, other than the fact here, that a minority cannot control the whole, the Union. A minority of the states cannot control the Union. It doesn't play. Keep going. Mm-hmm. Keep going with this now.
Every feature in the Constitution might thus be successively changed, and after a scene of unexampled confusion and distraction, what had been unanimously agreed to as a whole would not as a whole be agreed to by a single party. The amount of this modified right of nullification is that a single state may arrest the operation of a law of the U.S. and institute a process which is to terminate in the ascendancy of a minority over a large majority. In a Republican system, the characteristic rule of which is that the major will is the prevailing ruling will.
There you go. So basically what I've been saying is the majority.
Mm-hmm.
I alluded to the fact that he doesn't really clearly state this. You really have to break this out and go, well, there you go. He doesn't say that we have to have, and he doesn't articulate where that control really has to be within the union. But when you really look at Congress, Congress is this reflection of the union, right? Because each in the Senate, it has an equal representation. So 26 states will easily, you know, be a majority of the 100. Because that would mean that they would have, what, 52 senators against 48, a clear majority, where they will be able to go to vote and say, this is going to happen, and it shall happen. Now, when we look at the 26 states in the state legislature, this is why we go to 26 or 27 or 28, if necessary, if those state legislatures do not make, or I should say, not the state legislatures, if the representatives in the House of Representatives does not reach a majority of control, then you have to go to the next state up. Now, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you actually have 200, and the numbers won't work right. I'm just going to throw them out here. You have 220 that are the numbers of those who are not from the dark red states. And you have 210 of those from the dark red state, you do not have a majority. You have to have a majority. So go ahead. And this newfangled theory.
Yeah. And this newfangled theory is attempted to be fathered on Mr. Jefferson, the apostle of republicanism, and whose own words declare that acquiescence in the decision of the majority is the vital principle of it. See his inaugural address.
There you go. Okay, so that wasn't in the resolutions. It was in his inaugural address, in his very first inaugural address in 1801. Go ahead.
Well, might Virginia declare, as her legislature did by a resolution of 183, that her resolutions of 98 to 99 gave no support to the nullifying doctrine of South Carolina, and well may the friends of Mr. Jefferson disclaim any sanction to it or to any constitutional right of nullification from his opinions. His memory is fortunately rescued from such imputations by the very document procured from his files and so triumphantly appealed to by the nullifying partisans of every description. In this document, the remedial right of nullification is expressly called a natural right, and consequently not a right derived from the Constitution, but from abuses or usurpations releasing the parties to it from their obligation.
Right. Okay. And he kind of covered that in his report, basically with, you know, the breach of the part becomes a breach of the whole. Okay. Okay. So keep going.
No example of the inconsistency of party zeal can be greater than is seen in the value allowed to Mr. Jefferson's authority by the nullifying party, whilst they disregard his repeated assertions of the federal authority, even under the Articles of Confederation, to stop the commerce of a refractory state, whilst they abhor his opinions and propositions on the subject of slavery, and overlook his declaration that in a republic it is a vital principle that the minority must yield to the majority. They seize on an expression of Mr. Jefferson that nullification is the rightful remedy, as the shibboleth.
Right.
I'm not sure what that word is. As the shibboleth of their party and almost a sanctification of their cause. But in addition to your inconsistency, their zeal is guilty of the subterfuge of dropping a part of the language of Mr. Jefferson, which shews his meaning to be entirely at variance with the nullifying construction. His words in the document appealed to as the infallible test of his opinions are...
Okay, so you can see how he's really defending Jefferson.
Yeah.
Okay, or at least he's really diving into... You know, how the referencing of Jefferson, you know, you can't construe these things. So this is where he actually dives into it. So go ahead and 44. This is where this one paragraph, the very first part of this paragraph, is quoted by the single state nullifiers as claiming, and they make you think that this is it. This is the paradigm. Go ahead.
Thus, the right of nullification meant by Mr. Jefferson is the natural right, which all admit to be a remedy against insupportable oppression.
Stop.
Okay.
That line, that first line, thus the right of nullification meant by Mr. Jefferson, they basically are saying that James Madison and Thomas Jefferson support single state nullification. They're actually out there. You can actually find videos of people saying this that represent the John Birch Society, the 10th Amendment Center, and so forth. Now, that's a quote, you know, for that paragraph, for that sentence, quote, close quote. Now, read what follows.
It cannot be supposed for a moment that Mr. Jefferson would not revolt at the doctrine of South Carolina that a single state could constitutionally resist a law of the Union whilst remaining within it.
There you go. So how is it that they can get away they can get away with, and nobody call them out on that one citation? Why is it and how is it? Because nobody reads the citation they're citing to actually read the following sentence. They should be embarrassed for basically making the conclusion that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison support single state nullification.
Right.
They're going around preaching to people that this is the truth. That we can nullify. Now we're going into the end of the show. So we'll get back. When we come back, we will re-dive into this huge conclusion, this miscitation, this misinformation. And then I'll let you judge, folks. Am I wrong or am I right? I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.